There are two issues in this case. There is an issue. The first issue is whether the appellant's jury waiver was properly filed in the trial court and whether the trial court had jurisdiction to decide the case and issue subsequent orders. The second issue concerns the restitution order that was made by the trial court judge at the time that he granted shock probation to the appellant, Ms. Lozier. I'd like to address the jury waiver issue first, if I may. Quite simply, this case involves the interpretation of this court's recent decision of State versus Pless, which was decided last year, and I believe originated in this county also, and also the construction of 29-4505, which is the statute concerning the proper way to file a jury waiver. Quite simply, this court in State versus Pless said that that statute, 29-4505, must be strictly construed and applied. And there are four elements that must be met in that particular statute
according to. How is your case different?
Our case is different in only one respect, Your Honor. Our case is different in that the actual jury waiver form is found in the trial court file. That was not present in play. That is the only difference, but it really shouldn't matter in the way this court decides the case. The first two elements of the form.
It's not file stamped.
It's not file stamped, and it's not otherwise made part of the record. The fact
that it isn't stamped or made part of the record, didn't we decide that in State v. Haught?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Didn't we decide that in State v. Haught?
Well, Your Honor, I'm afraid I'm not familiar with State v. Haught, quite honestly.
I think that was the case where we said that unless there's an actual file stamp on it,
yes,
regardless of whether it's available, it is not filed.
That's correct, and I think that's what Pless says implicitly, is that it must be filed in the court.
Well, except in Pless, there was nothing in the record.
There was nothing in the record.
Here you have one that's contained in the file.
Yes.
But still not stamped.
That's correct.
Okay.
And it's not otherwise made a part of the record either. So actually the third and fourth elements of the four required are not here.
Well, do you need any of the elements if the rule is that it has to be stamped?
No.
It's over then.
I believe so, Your Honor. I would move on to the second issue, which is restitution. In this particular matter, if this court decides that the jury waiver is not proper, then the trial court had no jurisdiction to try the case, and the restitution order is void on its face. However, if somehow this court would decide that the jury waiver was proper, then the restitution order needs to be addressed. Quite simply, this is a case interpreting 29-5102 of the revised code, which is the probation statute, which also applies when shock probation is granted under the old statutes that no longer exist. And what the statutes provide is that restitution can be ordered by the trial court if it's a theft case or property damage. Then the trial court has the authority to issue restitution as a condition of probation or as part of the sentence. In this particular case, my client was convicted of perjury and tampering with evidence, neither one of which is a theft offense, and there's certainly no property damage. So there's absolutely no authority whatsoever for the trial court to issue restitution in this case.
What about your language, including but not limited to, that gives you sort of broad powers?
Your Honor, I think what that language is referring to are orders other than restitution. I think what 29-5102 tries to do is limit restitution to property damage or theft offenses, and other conditions other than restitution can be made a part of probation. And I think if one thinks that through, Your Honor, it makes a lot of sense, because if you have a case where there's a theft or where there's property damage in a criminal case, the value is determined as part of the criminal case. If there are other issues involved, that's better left to the civil courts to find the proper remedy and determine the amount involved.
Do you dispute the $10,000 as a adequate measure of?
Certainly, Your Honor. I don't think there's any basis in the record for the $10,000 restitution order. This is a case where there's no ascertainable loss by the victims.
But doesn't the trial court have great latitude in making conditions for probation?
Certainly, but that latitude is based on the statute, and there has to be authority within the statute for the trial court to order a condition of probation or to order any sentence.
Well, he can order anything, really, in probation. I can't see him being hamstrung by an interpretation of a statute that you make that has to be done in the theft case. How can you do that to a trial court? They should have the ability to fashion a conditions of probation as they see it.
They should, Your Honor, as long as it's reasonably related to the offense for which the person was convicted.
What's unreasonable about making restitution or paying a fine or whatever? What's unreasonable
about
that?
What's unreasonable about making restitution in this case is that there's absolutely no evidence whatsoever that the victim suffered any loss. There's absolutely no evidence whatsoever. This case involved my client making false accusations concerning crimes against two men.
All right, let's put it this way. If there was evidence of loss in this case, it's not a theft case, would it be all right?
If there's property damage directly involved, but the trial court's authority.
No, wait a minute. Let's go back. You said there's no loss. You said there's no loss in this case. If there was loss in this case, then the restitution would be proper.
Only if it's a result of a theft offense, and this is not a theft offense. The remedy is with the legislature. The legislature set forth
the
statute.
So you have to have a loss in a theft case?
Yes. Or property damage, according to the statute.
Okay.
And I know that there is some broad language concerning other conditions of probation, but they are very specific in limiting restitution to theft cases and property damage. And if the victim has a loss of some other matter, some financial concern or something, then his proper remedy is to file a civil lawsuit. But in this particular case, there is certainly no evidence of any loss by these victims, other than the extraordinary inconvenience of being accused of a crime and then later finding out that was a false accusation.
Well, no, isn't that a bit of an understatement? If you were wrongfully accused of a crime, I think you would regard it as more than extraordinary inconvenience.
Certainly, Your Honor, but my remedy is filing a civil lawsuit.
Isn't your point the fact that there are no liquidated damages? There would be no way to determine in the criminal proceeding the exact amount of restitution. The judge just said, make restitution.
Exactly, Your Honor. In this particular case, the judge ordered $5,000 to each victim, $5,000, and there's absolutely no basis. And I think our Court of Appeals recognized that, and at least saying that this case has to go back for a due process hearing. One, to determine the amount of loss and if it's related to these particular incidents, and two, my client's ability to pay.
Would your argument still be the same if, as a result of this, they had to seek medical treatment for psychological problems that they suffered and they incurred medical bills? Are you still taking the position they'd have to go file a separate civil suit and the judge has no power to make that victim whole?
That's exactly my point, Your Honor, and I base that argument on the statute. And there's case law out of this.
If you buy your argument that the including but not limited to language actually limits the judge, I read that rather expansively, and you read it rather inclusively.
Well, I think I read it inclusively because they delineate what restitution can be made. And it's not only under 29, it's not only under the probation statute, but under the sentencing statute as well, 29-29-11, which also limits it to property and theft damage. I'm not saying that in a perfect world, perhaps that might not be a good resolution, but we have to go by what's in the statute. And the proper method for recovering medical bills, for example, would be to have the legislature amend the statute and provide for that. And it's simply not provided for in the statute. And our Court of Appeals, in a reported decision of State versus Wolgamuth, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, states that medical expenses are not recoverable as part of restitution. And we also have the victims of crime provision, which I do believe covers medical bills.
But it allows the offender then to go scot-free, doesn't it?
No, not at all. File a lawsuit. If the person has the ability to pay, they'll be held responsible.
That's putting an awful lot of burden on the victim when you have a system that's already available to you with the court and you have language that says, in the interest of doing justice I would think would require rehabilitation, rehabilitating the offender, ensuring his good behavior. The court may impose additional requirements on the offender, including but not limited to requiring the offender to make restitution for all or part of the property damage, et cetera. And that's you're reading that to say you can only require it for property damage.
And I believe that's the way State versus Trevetti and some other cases have ruled, is that restitution can only be made in that situation.
Counsel, if we were to hold for you on the first issue regarding the jurisdiction of the trial court, what's the proper disposition that you ask this for?
I would ask the court to remand the case for a new trial, and the second issue concerning restitution becomes moot. That's a void order because the court did not have jurisdiction. And the whole thing starts over and basically start from the beginning like nothing.
Well, in fact, the second issue is a certified question to us. The first one is the discretionary appeal.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So we would find that there really is no conflict if there was no valid order.
That's correct, Your Honor. I'll save my remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Parker. Mr. Fry.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Good morning, Justices. My name is Chris Fry. I'm representing, along with Assistant County Prosecutor Gail Baker, the state of Ohio in this matter. With the court's indulgence, I would like to address the first assignment of error, that being the jury waiver, and Ms. Baker deal with the issue of restitution or reparations. Your Honor, the appellant in this case is seeking to have this court do more than apply plus. He's asking, or she is asking, that plus be extended past the terms of plus itself. In State v. Plus, there was no jury waiver in the file. Therefore, that jury waiver was not part of the record. In this case, there is a jury waiver in the file. It is accompanied by a journal entry from the Common Pleas Court, and that journal entry specifically references the executed jury waiver.
Your case is more like Larkin's, isn't it?
Our case is much more like Larkin's, Your Honor, other than the fact that this is on direct appeal versus the habeas. But factually, this is much more like Larkin's, where the majority of this court found a valid waiver of the jury trial.
How is it different from Haught?
Well, Your Honor, the decision in Haught, if I recall that correctly, was a paragraph that said no more than the decision in that case was affirmed, reversed on the basis of State v. Plus. That's the extent of the opinion of the court. There is a lengthy dissent that I'm aware
not really. Of. Not really. As a matter of fact, one of the dissents says the majority in following Plus finds the failure to timestamp a waiver of a jury trial in a criminal case divested the trial court of jurisdiction. It's pretty clear what the majority held, isn't it?
Your Honor, what I think this court is doing with that is putting this mark of the clerk of courts paramount to the issue of whether the document is filed.
Okay, I'm not arguing the merits of it. Isn't that what that case holds?
It's a brief opinion affirmed based on plus.
So to rule for you, we would have to overrule a case that we just decided on October 16th, 1996.
And in due respect to the court, I think that decision is in error.
Okay, that's fine, and you know, that's fair, but we ought to be told that, because I haven't seen it in any of the briefing even. And Haught is clearly on point, is it not?
It is on point in the factual situation, Your Honor. I believe Haught may have been decided after this case was briefed. This has been on the calendar for some extended period of time. It was originally scheduled to be argued last January and was rescheduled for today.
We do have a provision in the rule for additional authorities.
Absolutely, and I'm not my axe to cite that case to this court where it holds against me, Your Honor.
But the statute requires that it be filed. Now, for us to rule in your favor, wouldn't we have to change the accepted definition of filing?
In due respect to Your Honor, no. I don't think we have to accept change the definition.
Would you explain that?
I would be delighted to. There is an 1885 case cited in the appellant's brief, referenced in an insurance of North America versus Reese, and it defines in there what filing is. Filing is placing the document with the keeper of that document in the place that document is to be kept. And this jury waiver was given to the clerk of courts in the court's file with the journal entry memorializing it. It appears on the docket. The journal entry appears on the docket, and it is in fact in the place where it's to be kept. That document is filed. I think the combination of the listing on the docket sheet, the accompanying journal entry that memorializes it, and the placing of that document in the file is filed. And I don't think it requires a redefining that term.
So if we find in a file a notice of appeal that was filed past the 45-day limit in the Supreme Court or the 30-day limit in the trial court, if it's in the file, then it must have been filed. Statute of limitations has no effect.
If you're saying to me, Your Honor, that it was filed after the filing date,
nobody knows. It's just there.
Well,
see, that's the problem we had in Pless, and I wrote Pless. And one of the reasons that happened in Pless is because it was very clearly in the It was in the record because it was in the transcript.
But the waiver was not part of the file, and that was a distinction in plus, Your Honor, and I understand the difficulty, and that doesn't make the fact that the document is filed or not filed determinative. Mm-hmm. The stamp is an indicia of filing, and I recognize that, and it may well be the best indicia of filing.
If I could interject, you had mentioned that it was also on the journal. Is there a date on the journal that shows when it was entered?
There's a date on the docket sheet, Your Honor, that shows the jury waiver filed 9-7 of 93.
So that would be a little bit different. This case is certainly distinguishable.
Absolutely. It's distinguishable, factually distinguishable from PLUS.
You know, this is such an easy requirement to comply with, is it not? There's really nothing difficult here for counsel or for defense counsel to comply with. Why do we make it so difficult? How we decided the issue? Now we're back arguing again. Why?
Because we have a plethora of cases, Your Honor, that exist in the system between the time PLUS was decided. This case certainly was tried prior to the PLUS decision coming out, prior to the Hout decision coming out.
So should the law be different for those cases, the cases that are in the system?
I'm not suggesting that. You're asking why there are so many, and I'm attempting to address that.
No, not so many. I'm just wondering why we're arguing this issue again when the requirement is the statute, it's clear, and why we make it difficult?
I think in this case, pardon me, Your Honor.
I think the difficulty.
Well, I'd like to hear the counsel answer, but
I think that the distinction here is a factual distinction as to what constitutes filing. I think that's what makes this case distinct from PLUS, from Hout. Here we have the document. We have a journal entry memorializing that document. And what I'm asking this court to do today is to recognize that jury waiver is therefore filed.
But let's end the factual determinations and say it has to be stamped. And then we wouldn't have all
but
these
But that's
appeals.
Not the statute, Your Honor.
Well, why don't we just
well,
say
perhaps,
that and end
perhaps.
It?
Perhaps. But the Chief Actually, Justice has asked, you know, what's so hard about this? And I'm loathe to answer that there's something particularly difficult about it. I don't know why defense counsel doesn't file this document.
Wait a minute. That is the statute, though. The
That's
statute
right.
specifically says Stamped. It shall be made. It shall be filed and made part of the record.
Right. Absolutely.
All right. In just a second. And filed then has to be interpreted.
Right.
We
yes.
took great pains. That's why we took the case of Haught, because it was a variation of PLUS. And we had to finally make the decision, what does filed mean? Now, I don't know about the procedure in your office, but in my office when I was there, the secretary used to say to me, go over to the courthouse, file this pleading, I've given you three copies, get one stamped and bring it back. So we had it in the file. Doesn't that happen with you in the notice of appeal?
Certainly, Your Honor.
Okay, so you know what filing means,
Absolutely,
don't you?
Absolutely, I know what...
That's fine.
I know what a file stamp is,
okay.
And I know that that's the best indicia
Why do you
of
suppose
filing?
We do that?
Because it's the best indicia of filing, Your Honor.
Filing, good.
So
that's
why,
what the statute says.
Why make an exception here? Because we have to tinker with the law, don't we? Well, we have a... Filing means stamped, or there's some objective standard. Now, but maybe for this situation... It's different. Why should we do that?
Your Honor, you have a situation where you have a defendant and defense counsel and a judge and perhaps a jury pool ready to go. Defendant makes an 11th hour election to try the case to the court as opposed to the jury. And they'll execute a jury waiver there in the presence of the court. They'll have the on-the-record colloquy to ensure that it's a knowing and voluntary waiver. And, you know, then we're going to stop the proceedings. And we're going to send someone off down to the clerk's office to file this document, to bring it back up, hand it to the judge.
Is that difficult?
I'm not saying that it's an insurmountable burden.
Well, I mean, in balancing the two issues here, it seems to me that might be better to hold up the trial for 5 minutes than to ask us to write law that's mushy.
And it may well be the better course, Your Honor, but is it the required course? Here we have a journal entry from the judge saying, I got this waiver. I've got it.
But counsel, then you say it is the burden. You make the argument that it's the burden of defense counsel to file this. I'm
it's
interested in that. To the extent that if we say that it is the burden of defense counsel, is there an issue here about invited error?
We raised that issue in our brief that it was invited error. Unfortunately, this court has looked at it strictly as a jurisdictional issue that can be raised at any time. I'm not going to argue that point. It's certainly a defense document. It is their pleading, their election alone to make.
Well, at this point in the state of the decisional law, you would think that everybody in the courtroom will consider it their obligation.
Well, I certainly think we do now. Yes, Your Honor, I think we do.
The dilemma you put some of us in is that here you have a statute that seems to be on its face absolutely clear. Now, if we write in substantial compliance, now we're liberal activist judges again, because the General Assembly has given us this specific language, and I've heard your office argue it time and time again. Judge, apply the statute as it's there. I see Mr. Saad sitting behind you, who argues that to us regularly. The statute's there. Now, if we then say, no, we're going to apply the statute as it is, then we're liberal activist judges because we're giving a new trial on a technicality. So shouldn't we just apply the statute as we find it?
Your Honor, the statute says filed and made part of the record. It doesn't say file stamped and made part of the record. And really the issue here is this document filed? I think all the indicia is that it is filed. I don't think this court has to extend PLESS or reverse PLESS to say that this document complied strictly with the requirements of 294505.
Counsel, we've just struggled with this issue twice recently, and we didn't all agree, but we have now two opinions out there that provide very specific guidance on this. You would have a step back, and apparently the rule that you would like is if you can find evidence that it was executed, that it existed, if you can find the document in the courthouse, I guess. What if the document turns up in the judge's file but is never found in the clerk's file? Is that going to be good enough?
It would not be, Your Honor, and I'd say it's not because it's not with the keeper of the document. The keeper of the document is the clerk. In this case, it ended up with the keeper of the document. It ended up in the place it was supposed to be. It ended up where anyone and everyone could have notice that this individual waived the jury. The whole point of the filing is to give all of us notice of what occurred. And in this case, that happened. It may not have been precisely the way we would choose it, but it happened. In fact, it happened, and I don't think it requires us to reverse anything other than to say filing does not automatically mean file stamped.
That's essentially the point I made in my dissent in Hott.
It is, Your Honor.
Point you would want us to adopt as a majority now, which I think does take a step back because my dissent did not make it a majority opinion.
I'm aware of that, Your Honor. What I'm asking this court to do is to look at the totality of the circumstances in this case, to look at the journal entry memorializing the jury waiver, the fact that that journal entry appears on the docket, the fact of the waiver appearing appears on the docket. I don't think that it requires this court to do any more than to affirm the concept that filing does not automatically or per se mean a file stamp on the document. That's what we're asking.
Was Ms. Baker going to argue?
She is, Your Honor, and I apologize for taking
less than 2 minutes,
so much time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. The government would like to emphasize to the court that there are two distinct statutes. 295102 governs probation. It gives the guidelines to the trial court for styling conditions of probation. 2929.11 is a sentencing statute where the trial court judge is restricted in his ability to fashion conditions or terms of sentencing. The appellant argues that the appellate argues that restitution should be confined to theft offenses and then the value of property caused by damage due to the offense. We argue that the trial court has the discretion to fashion conditions of probation, that restitution and reparation is a valid condition of probation. Ms. Lozier was in prison. She moved the court for shock probation. The court granted probation, and as a condition of that probation, she was asked to pay restitution to the victims. Thank you, Your Honor. I see my time is up.
Thank you, Ms. Baker. Mr. Parker, you've saved almost 5 minutes of your time.
Very briefly, just in response to Mr. Frye's argument about the time stamp, whether it needs to be on there or not, and that's not really filing, I would direct the court's attention to two separate things. One, a case that this court decided well over 100 years ago, which prohibited a defendant from waiving a jury, State versus Williams. The right to a jury trial is so sacred, and this court at one time prohibited a person from waiving that. Over the years, we've developed these statutes and other cases that allows someone to waive the sacred right to a jury trial if these statutes are complied with strictly. And I would direct the court's attention to the duty of the clerk of court, which is found in Chapter 230308 of the Revised Code in 09, which says the clerk of court shall file and carefully preserve all papers.
How can a clerk file something if you don't give it to them to file?
Well, that's precisely the problem in this case. The waiver was never presented to.
But is that your responsibility as defense attorney, or is that the prosecutor? I mean, the prosecutor's not seeking the jury waiver. Your client is. Wouldn't that be your responsibility? And if you don't go down and file it, doesn't that become your invited error?
I don't think it's invited error. It's a question of jurisdiction. I think the court has a responsibility before it proceeds with the trial to make sure it has jurisdiction. And it's quite clear that a court simply doesn't have jurisdiction until this waiver is properly filed and made a part of the record. I think it's the court's responsibility to ensure that that is properly filed and should not proceed unless that is done. I think as a practical matter, down at the Justice Center, get a jury waiver filed, the judge makes a request that you go down to the second floor and file it and bring back a copy.
But this is a little bit different because of the fact that it was journalized on the docket.
I don't think that matters, quite honestly, Your Honor. And the reason it doesn't matter is that the actual waiver itself must be filed. Okay, that's what the statute requires, not another piece of paper, a journal entry memorializing that it was in fact waived. We know from the transcript that a jury was waived. It was voluntarily done. We have a piece of paper. We're not arguing fraud here. Okay? And I think fraud's an important point because the reason the clerk of court is the keeper of the court's paper is to ensure that there is no fraud. And that's why a timestamp is so important. And that's why under 230309 and 08, the clerk shall endorse on each pleading or paper filed in his office the time of the filing. And that's what is required by the statute here, 294505. Without that, it's not a filing. I would love to take a motion to suppress, go up to a judge's chambers one afternoon when he's busy with something else, ask the bailiff for the court file so I can look at something, slip the motion to suppress in there because I forgot to file it, and then show up on the day of trial and say, but judge, we have a motion to suppress to argue. He goes, well, it's not in here. Boom, there it is. But there's no timestamp. That's why we have timestamps. So there is no fraud, so there's an orderly administration of justice. I'd ask that the court reverse this case for a new trial.
You'd never do that, though, to a judge, would you?
I would never. Thank you,
Mr. Parker. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.